Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, more than half of MBTA facilities are in need of significant repair.
You wouldn't say about a highway system, well, we're going to leave the potholes there, and don't worry about it, right? Just worry about getting there safe. You wouldn't say that.
Plus, powerhouses like Amazon and Walmart may be the reason you're not getting a raise.
Labor markets in which employers are concentrated, those labor markets have lower wages.
Also today, why some people are putting their faith in lightly regulated Mexican clinics that use psychedelic drugs to treat opioid addiction.
I was ready to die anyways, so I'd rather take this chance and be able to live a normal life than to, you know, not take this chance and die a horrible death on dope.
And Serena Williams at the U.S. Open this weekend.
You owe me an apology. I have never cheated in my life. I have a daughter, and I stand what's right for her, and I've never cheated. And you owe me an apology.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Those of you who take the T to work or ride the commuter rail have probably noticed that the stations aren't all in tip-top shape. Some have got crumbling concrete, others leaky pipes. Maybe you've looked up, noticed some peeling paint. Well, turns out the MBTA agrees. A preliminary review of facilities showed that more than half are in need of significant repairs. But what's the T to do? Especially given that they're still struggling with an issue that's, for most riders, a higher priority, reliable train service. For more, we're joined by former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and vocal advocate for transit improvements, Jim Aloisi. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Jim.
Thanks for having me here, Evan.
Oh, it's amazing to have you here, to sit across the table from you. I've been reading your stuff for so long. I'm sure you've seen the Globe's reporting on this morning, if not the MBTA review itself. What did you make of this finding that 57% of MBTA facilities need significant repair?
Well, the number is shocking, although I would say as a frequent transit rider, anyone who's using the system probably sort of knew this already just by observation, right?
It's an open secret.
It's an open secret. I'm delighted, by the way, and high marks to the T for being transparent about these issues. I think it's important that they've done this, and I think it's good for them that they've done it. But now it raises the question whether we can chew gum and walk at the same time. We have to invest in service reliability stuff at the T. But we can't
That's
ignore.
That's the making the trains run
making
part.
The trains run without delay and on time and providing a level of customer service. But we also have to have stations that aren't have, you know, like the Boston Logan Blue Line that aren't peeling, the ceiling isn't peeling off on them. And you have to have parking facilities where people can safely park their cars.
Without concrete falling.
Without concrete
I mean, there was
falling.
This issue at Alewife, right?
Yeah. Right, at Alewife. And you have to have, you know, an elevators that 6 months after, more than 6 months after the winter storm, still don't function at Aquarium Station. So you see these issues at stations and parking facilities. Some of it is because they lack resilience. Some of it is because there's a state of good repair gap. Some of it is because perhaps we need to reassess our routine and program maintenance protocols. So it's not just one factor, it's many.
But behind a lot of those factors, money.
Behind every factor is money. And I think it goes to, you know, those folks who think that we can do everything we need to do at the T with the current revenue stream are just plain out wrong. And every time the T, to its credit, is transparent about its needs, it proves that reform without revenue is a losing proposition. It's always been a losing proposition. It continues to be.
Now, Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack told the Globe that repairing or upgrading facilities is just not as high a priority as buying new vehicles or improving tracks or equipment. You think that's fair? I mean, this gets back to the walk and chew gum issue. Do you think that's a fair response or not really?
I think it's a false equivalency with all respect. Of course, everyone needs a safe and reliable system. But imagine buying a new fleet of red or orange line cars that get stuck in a facility that it's going to rain on them or that it's going to some pieces of concrete will fall. It doesn't make sense to make the investments we're making in new cars and new systems and not also think about the quality of the associated infrastructure. It says a lot about how we think about transit when we let situations like the crumbling parking facility at Alewife, or like the peeling ceiling at Logan Airport, or the failed elevators at Aquarium. It says a lot about how we think about transit when we basically let those things fester and don't think of them as an equal priority.
But reform, reform. I mean, you mentioned the mantra that has been sort of the leading mantra of the MBTA, of this administration and prior administrations: reform before revenue. That is, if you don't get the governance working right at the MBTA, it doesn't matter how much money you throw at them. They won't use it properly, and that's not how you want to handle things.
I think the penny pinchers who like to penny pinch will never have enough reform. There'll always be more reform before there's any revenue. We desperately need net new revenue to invest in the system, both in state of good repair and in fighting this issue, this growing issue of resilience, particularly in the blue line, and in doing strategic expansions. The MBTA, for example, is going to be a hearing next Monday, a week from today, on the subject of connecting the red and blue lines. It's not even in their plan to connect the red and blue lines. There, you need to have money to be able to do these strategic expansions. Otherwise, I really fear access to jobs, access to health care, access, the kind of access that makes our quality of life strong, will begin to diminish.
It does seem like when you add it up, though, it can seem really daunting to generate the kind of revenue needed to fix all these problems. I mean, we have the service reliability issues.
Yes.
We have now the station repair issues. And then you're talking about expansions, new connectors, red and blue, North Station, South Station. Is there really a path to the kind of revenue needed to produce a system that would make you happy?
There's a path, and you don't do everything at once, right? But there is a path. And I think you need to think about one of the leading problems in transportation mobility in the greater Boston area these days is traffic congestion. It's chronic. It's growing. It's a danger to our economy. It's actually a danger to our quality of life. Everyone knows it. Everyone sees it every day. The only way to get out of that is to invest in alternative modes, and transit is that mode, whether it's intercity rail, which we call commuter rail, or whether it's the inner core system of subway and bus. That's the way to reduce congestion. Look, we say we care about emissions and air quality and quality of life. Our policies today are encouraging the use of more vehicles, whether it's Uber or Lyft. That's the issue with the red and blue. If you live, if you work in Kendall Square and you need to get to the airport in a hurry on a business, on a plane for business, you can't get there on the T. It's not possible. So you take Uber or Lyft, or you drive.
Are you agnostic as to where the revenue comes from, or you have preferences? Like, imagine you're in charge once again with even greater powers than you had in the past, right? And
my
you get
head
to
is
decide.
Swelling.
Yeah. Okay. Swell. Let it swell. Does it matter to you, or you think there's a better approach? Say the millionaire's tax, raising the income tax, vehicle miles traveled to charge people based on how much they drive, gasoline tax. There are lots of paths. Does it matter which path we take?
I think it matters. I'm more of a proponent of looking to the transportation sector. So, for example, we don't really charge Uber and Lyft enough for the impacts that they have on the system. Let's revisit the legislation that was passed a few years ago and get it right. We didn't get it right the first time. And let's charge them for their impacts. We're not doing that now. How about a carbon impact fee on every non-residential parking space in Boston and Cambridge and dedicating that money to transit to save cycling lanes? We're not assessing vehicles for their impacts on emissions and for their impacts on congestion. If we began to do that in a fair and transparent way, we'd begin to unlock the funding paradigm.
I did like one thing in your piece, which is that you highlight the importance of the stop at Logan, just mm-hmm. because it's symbolic. Do you feel that way about that stop?
Yeah, for me, it is highly symbolic that we say we care about quality of life in transit. Here's our international airport, by the way, doing very well, more nonstop flights internationally than ever before, 38 million passengers this year. And if a passenger wants to have sustainable mobility, or a passenger gets off of Logan and is staying at the Marriott Long Wharf, that passenger's experience on the blue line begins with the ceiling that looks like you're in a third world country. It shouldn't have to be that way. And then if the passenger steps off at Aquarium with his or her bags, there's no elevator in service because the station is not resilient.
That's Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a principal at TriMount Consulting. Thanks so much for joining us.
Evan, it's been a pleasure.
If opioid addiction got a hold of you or a loved one, how far would you go for a chance to break free? Every year, thousands of Americans cross the border to Mexico as medical tourists, looking for lower costs or alternative treatments, and increasingly, that includes people with opioid addictions, headed to one of the dozens of clinics in Mexico that use psychedelic drugs as part of a regime they say can cure addiction. WBUR's Deborah Becker followed one man who flew from Boston to Mexico for a thinly regulated addiction treatment using the substance Ibogaine.
Walking through a park near his mother's house in Dover, New Hampshire last month, 36-year-old Dustin Dextrays was so dope sick, he was having trouble focusing.
I didn't know they really did it up down here.
Yeah, it's nice. It's really nice.
Oh, I'm more interested in walking around town looking for someone to get dope.
Dextrays stopped several people asking for money or drugs. Occasionally, he groaned.
It's all right. You okay?
Yeah, I'm going to be all right. I mean, I have to be until I go find someone to find something for me.
Dextrays started taking prescription pills recreationally about 3 years ago. He quickly became addicted and then switched to heroin because it was easier to get and cheaper. During those 3 years, he lost his job, he left his wife and three children, and now sometimes stays with his father in Massachusetts or his mother in New Hampshire, constantly trying to get drugs.
It's not like Massachusetts where I can just walk down the street and get it from anybody. $5, and I wouldn't be sick.
Dextrays says he hates this cycle of panhandling to get more drugs, and he says he's tried to quit. He's been to several detoxes, rehabs, he's taken addiction medication, attended 12-step meetings, but nothing, he says, has helped him achieve long-term sobriety. Also, his drug use led him to be hospitalized with a blood infection. He has hepatitis C, and he went to jail for drug possession. At one point, he says he just wanted to give up.
I tried to overdose about a week ago, and I just woke up like 5 hours later, and the needle was in my arm, and I just woke up and was like, didn't die, so.
Why'd you try to overdose?
Because I was just like fed up and sick of this and like didn't think that it's ever going to get better. It makes you kind of feel hopeless.
What's giving Dextrays some hope is an alternative psychedelic treatment that he has to go out of the country to get because it's illegal in the U.S. It's the psychedelic Ibogaine from the Iboga plant, which grows in West Africa. For decades, people have been reporting that it eliminates withdrawal symptoms and drug cravings. So Dextrays plans to go to Mexico to try it.
I've tried everything that they've offered me to try, and this is the last thing like that I know of is the Ibogaine. My whole life is, like, riding on, like, this Ibogaine.
Ibogaine is believed to carry serious risks, especially to the heart. 19 deaths are blamed on Ibogaine use between 1990 and 2008, most of them because of the lack of medical oversight, which brings up another potential issue, medical oversight in Mexico, where Ibogaine is not illegal, but it's not exactly sanctioned. Dr. Martin Polanco used to run an Ibogaine clinic in Mexico. He closed it last year because of concerns about the security of his staff and his patients. He says he's confident that Ibogaine is safe, but patients should do a lot of research before going to a clinic in Mexico.
It's not prosecuted, but that doesn't mean it's approved either. So it's kind of a gray area.
Dr. Polanco has researched Ibogaine and says it should be further studied in the United States.
It does eliminate withdrawal, and this is unlike any other medication in Western medicine.
The pharmaceutical company Savant is testing a synthetic compound that mimics Ibogaine without the psychoactive aspects. Those have kept the drug illegal in the U.S. and diminished scientific testing. Dextrays, though, is hoping to trip. He says that might shed light on the reasons behind his addiction. And any potential risks, he says, don't scare him because his drug use has already put him in a dangerous, desperate place.
I was ready to die anyways, so I'd rather take this chance and be able to live a normal life than to, you know, not take this chance and die a horrible death on dope.
So Dextrays fills out several clinic forms about his medical history and his drug use to get ready to spend a week at an Ibogaine clinic just over the California border. His mom bought his plane ticket, and friends helped pay for the treatment, which averages $5,000 a week. Tomorrow, We follow Dextrace to Mexico to see what Ibogaine treatment there is all about.
That's WBUR's Deborah Becker. You can hear part two of her three-part series tomorrow. Stay with us. Coming up, are growing corporate powers like Amazon slowing wage growth? I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. It's the one still weak link in our otherwise high-performing economy, wages. They're just not growing as fast as expected, given the low unemployment rate and the recent jump in GDP. One problem may be that businesses have gotten too big. They have too much power. Think of how Amazon dominates the online marketplace and Walmart, the brick and mortar. Or think of how two pharmacies have gobbled up an industry that used to include thousands of small and independent pharmacists. Without robust competition, companies like these have less need to fight for customers or workers. Increasingly, economic leaders are considering policies to regulate these overgrown businesses in order to keep American capitalism competitive. Here to tell us more is Harvard economist Jason Furman. He served as an economic advisor to former President Obama. Jason, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Oh, it's great to have you. I mean, there's been a real groundswell of research into these sorts of questions about market concentration and its impact. What's your take?
Sure. I've been, I think, contributed to that groundswell in research for the last couple of years. And, you know, it's just a remarkable fact that throughout the economy, as you just said, you gave a few anecdotes, but you look at the data and you see exactly the same thing you just said. Throughout the economy, there are just fewer players in almost every segment of our lives. It's complicated what the reasons for that is. It has lots of different consequences, but one of the unambiguous consequences seems to be giving more power to employers, less power to workers when it comes to setting wages. And so it's shifted the share of income away from workers towards corporate profits.
I mean, you say it goes way beyond the companies we're talking about. You have an example industry. Is the one that always is sitting in your head, like, why aren't people talking about this industry? That's where there's real concentration.
No, I mean, one is the beer industry, where there's pretty much two companies now that are responsible for almost all of it. You wouldn't know that because they've bought up a lot of the smaller brands and marketed under a lot of different names. The airlines haven't done that, so there we know that it's just a couple airlines we have, and the budget airlines have basically converged and become like the premium ones. So, you know, that's another sector where we have, you know, just two sectors that we have less choice than we used to, and, you know, with consequences.
Are they big consequences or are they small? Like, can you give a sense of the scale of it? I mean, how much might it be affecting my paycheck, the average person's paycheck here in Massachusetts?
Well, this is something that economists, I think, are still trying to get their heads around. And there's not a definitive answer to that question. But I think it could be an important one. And I think it's an area that has been, you know, underexplored and underaddressed by policymakers. Like, usually when you think about wages, you think about the labor market and what you can do to the minimum wage or something like that. This says no. I mean, it not says no. It says yes, absolutely. You can still do minimum wage. But it says here's a whole other area you can add to your list. It turns out, you know, when they're doing antitrust, that might matter for your wages too. It's not just the minimum wage. It's if all the hospitals in Boston. Boston has had a lot of consolidation in the hospital sector. That's not good for the salary of nurses in the Boston area.
I mean, I can think of sort of two ways this might work. Would you tell me if there are others or if I'm getting this wrong? One would be, you know, let's stick with a hospital example. You know, you're working in one hospital. There's only one other place you can work. So if you want to go out and find an alternative job, there just aren't as many competitors for you to look for. So it's just harder. That is the two or the small number of companies control the labor market. The other would be sort of indirect. The companies don't have to innovate because it's so easy for them to get workers at relatively low prices. And if they're not innovating, then they don't get more productive. And in the long run, that hurts wages too. Am I right to be thinking about that, or is there other forces?
I think those are the two most important channels. The third channel I'd add is in some cases you've actually seen collusion. There have been cases brought against hospitals, not in this area, where they basically have an agreement to not pay nurses any more than each other, not to poach workers away from each other. And so that can exacerbate the first problem you talked about of if you don't have another option of where to work, you're going to have a harder time negotiating for pay. It's going to be even harder if all your options are colluding and coordinating with each other to avoid you getting that raise.
In some ways, this is very clear to me in the beer industry or some of the examples you're citing. It's harder to wrap my head around it in the online space. Like Amazon, right? Huge company, extremely powerful. But unlike the way I would normally think about monopolies, they don't seem to be pushing up prices. They seem to be pushing down prices. Is there something fundamentally different about the internet economy that means we just shouldn't worry about this as much?
Right. Well, throughout the economy, there's really two reasons you see this increase in concentration. Sometimes it's like you're not enforcing antitrust rules and you're allowing mergers that you didn't used to allow. That's what we've been seeing with hospitals, with airlines, with pharmacies, all the examples that you cited. Others are where something's incredibly efficient and that means it grows. That second type, you know, in some ways is less concerning, but it raises some of the, you know, same issues. People have talked about Amazon's wages and have raised concerns about those. They've raised concerns about what might happen in the future if you can't have another competitor there. But I absolutely agree with you. A lot of the reason for that rise is an enormous efficiency. So when addressing it, you want to see what you can do to keep that efficiency while addressing some of the negative side effects in the tech sector. That's really tricky.
I mean, I gather that you were recently selected to lead a government expert panel in the UK looking for ways to support competition in new tech markets. I mean, this is a new thing for you, as I understand it. Has it given you new thoughts about what we should be doing in tech markets to make sure they remain competitive?
Right. Well, we have a small group that includes economists, lawyers, technologists, and we've just started our work. We'll be reporting back next year with concrete recommendations for the United Kingdom, recommendations we hope have an influence on the United States, the European Union, and others around the world. And part of why I was excited to do this is I don't know the answer to the question. There's nothing better than being on an expert panel where you know a certain amount, but you really want to figure out the answer. And it gets back to what you said, which is part of why these digital giants have grown the way they've grown is because they're very successful innovators. They charge very low prices. But they've also grown by, you know, taking strategies to preclude other competitors, to buy up nascent challengers, and to make it harder to move from company to company. So how can you get the benefits while reducing those downsides will be what we're trying to figure out, and I'll know the answer by next year.
I guess I'll ask you then. In the meantime, there are other proposals on the table for how to deal with this. Last week, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Congressman Ro Khanna from California's 17th District introduced a bill, Stop Bad Employers by Zeroing Out Subsidies. And I read it that way. If it sounds sort of awkward, that's because they wanted the acronym Stop Bezos, the Stop Bezos Act, aimed, of course, at stopping Amazon founder Jeff Bezos from getting too big, too powerful, pushing down wages. This is how Senator Sanders explained it.
Congressman Connor and I are proposing legislation that would have Mr. Bezos, the Walton family of Walmart, and other billionaires get off of welfare and start paying their workers a living wage. The taxpayers of this country would no longer be subsidizing the wealthiest people in this country who are paying their workers inadequate wages.
Now, Amazon responded in part saying that, quote, Senator Sanders continues to spread misleading statements about pay and benefits, end quote. I'm sort of interested in the economics of this. Is this the kind of bill that would get at the problem or not?
You know, I understand the concern that Senator Sanders and Congressman Khanna have. If you look at their actual bill, it's less of a tax on the Waltons or on Jeff Bezos and more of a tax on hiring workers with less skill, and in particular, taxing companies that hire, you know, women with children who have lower wages. And the result of that, pretty much according to policy analysts across the political spectrum, from the pretty far left to the right, would be that you're going to hire fewer of those people. Companies aren't going to hire women with children anymore because they're afraid that they'll end up getting taxed with it. So I don't think this would take back any money from the people it's intended to. Instead, it would discourage hiring, lower wages, and I think it's really the wrong way to address the issue.
That does sound bad. I mean, if nothing else, it's a reminder that sometimes bills written with good intentions have unexpected, unintended, or can have unexpected, unintended negative consequences. Do you fear similarly unexpected, unintended consequences from, say, new regulatory regime? Like, let's say the government went about this by returning to the age of trust busting. Are there similar concerns there about possible unintended side effects?
You know, I should say one more thing on the Sanders-Khanna. You know, I think one lesson here is rather than do some Rube Goldberg, you know, try to get at something through a back door, just do it directly. You know, you want to tax those people? Raise taxes. You want people paid more? Raise the minimum wage. There's a direct way to do this that I think would be a lot better. I think with regulation, you always need to worry about unintended consequences. You always need to worry about something that sounds good that turns out to be bad. But I don't think you want to worry so much that you never want to act, because you can always come up with some story or something, you know, unintended consequence you're worried about. You have to ask, how serious is it? How likely is it? And how does that compare to the status quo? And is there a better way to do it? You know, with the bill we just talked about, there's clearly a better way to do it. In some other areas, you know, if you're making a decision about whether to let a tech giant buy another company, you know, you can't really be sure, but maybe we want to err on the side of fewer of those acquisitions going forward.
How about if we're considering letting a tech giant open up a new shop in town? Amazon, right? They've been scouring the country for the best place to open a new headquarters, and cities have been offering them nice packages to lure them to their region. Is that something cities should even be doing?
Cities should not be offering them those sorts of packages, because there's a real danger of what's called a winner's curse, that everyone bids up until the person who wins is the person who bid too much. Amazon is also more sophisticated than most of the city governments they're dealing with at the other end of this transaction. And this is a, you know, example of precisely what goes wrong in, you know, urban planning. You know, that being said, do I think if, you know, we didn't have to offer Amazon anything and they showed up here in Boston, I'm, you know, patriotic citizen of my new hometown, moved here a year ago, would be perfectly happy for it to win a contest. I'm afraid, though, what the cost of that winning might be.
I'm almost embarrassed. You keep giving me such good segues. You just moved here to Boston from D.C. You spent a lot of time in D.C., and I feel, while I have you on the phone, I have to ask how you feel watching the administration, the Trump administration, and the cabinet that has taken over from the administration that you served. I mean, the chaos that you see emanating from the White House, or the description of fear and chaos that has come out in Bob Woodward's book, in the anonymous op-ed. Do you have responses to this that draw on your own experience in the White House?
I mean, my job for the last 3.5 years of the Obama administration was to give President Obama the best possible economic analysis. That was always an input into a decision. He'd have to figure out if something could pass Congress, you know, how it would fit into the overall priorities, trade-offs, et cetera. But he never made a decision without taking that analysis seriously. We wrote him a memo. He'd read it beginning to end, and we'd get back an underlined version and stars and notes in the margin, so we'd even know what he was thinking as he read it. I can't imagine that this president does any of that. Maybe the least of the problems we have in this country. But as somebody that really believes in the importance of doing serious, sober analysis, understanding trade-offs, the fact that I don't think that's happening right now is, you know, one of the many contributors to, you know, I think, a set of problems that we have in this country.
Well, that's Jason Furman. He's a professor of economics at Harvard University, and he served as chair of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Obama White House. Thank you so much for joining us, Jason.
Great talking to you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. This year's women's final on the U.S. Open was rich with drama, and not just from the battle between 23-time Grand Slam champion Serena Williams and the upstart who bested her, 20-year-old Naomi Osaka. No, the tensest moments happened at the sidebar, when Williams confronted the umpire about a series of escalating penalties that cost her a point, and then a game, and now $17,000 in fines. Here Serena confronts the umpire during the match.
You owe me an apology. I have never cheated in my life. I have a daughter, and I stand what's right for her, and I've never cheated. And you owe me an apology.
Some of the infractions seemed clear-cut, like when Williams smashed her racket. Calling the umpire a thief was more a judgment call. But what really seemed to unnerve Williams was the charge that she had cheated by receiving coaching during the match. Also, the feeling that a man, behaving the same way, would not have gotten the same treatment.
I've seen other men call other umpires several things, and I'm here fighting for women's rights and for women's equality and for all kinds of stuff. And for me to say thief and for him to take a game, it made me feel like it was a sexist remark.
The Women's Tennis Association has called for equal treatment of players and to amend the rules to allow on-court coaching. But is there a disciplined double standard in tennis and beyond? Joining me now from New York is Soraya Nadia McDonald. She's a culture critic for The Undefeated. Her latest piece is titled, Serena Williams is Owed an Apology for Much More Than a Penalty. Hello, Soraya.
Hello.
Also with me in studio is Michael Jeffries. He's an associate professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. Hi, Michael.
Hi there.
Listeners, you can join us too. We want to hear from you on this. Are you surprised by Serena's treatment at the U.S. Open? Were you surprised by her behavior? Do you feel women in sports and in society are punished more harshly than their male counterparts? Are you surprised she didn't bring up race or that more people are talking about gender than race? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us tweets at Radio Boston. Soraya, let's start with you. You were there this weekend, I gather.
Yes.
Can you give us a sense for what it was like to watch this courtside?
So what's very strange about being in the stadium as this is going on, what the U.S. Open does is they provide these little earpieces so that you can hear the play-by-play if you choose to while the match is going on. And it was raining in New York this weekend, and so the roof was up on Arthur Ashe Stadium, which has a significant impact on the acoustics there. It definitely makes the roars of the crowd significantly louder. And so as this is starting to go on, you know, Serena's the American. She is the hometown favorite. This crowd just starts roaring.
Because they could sense that something was going – were they able to follow?
Yes. Because even if you couldn't – even if you couldn't hear what Serena was saying on the court, you could definitely see by her body language – that she was unhappy about something. And so you could definitely sense that, you know, she's got the crowd behind her, but you see her face, you see that pointed finger, you know something's not right.
And how unusual is it, Soraya? I mean, how often are there violations in tennis, violations that add up to penalty points, penalty games, defaults? Is it unusual? Is it more common than people realize?
Yes, I would say it's definitely pretty common for tempers to flare, especially in high-stakes games like finals of Grand Slams. And in particular, you know, there have been other players, male players, who have, in fact, confronted Carlos Ramos, the same chair umpire that Serena confronted, without ever losing a game. You know, this has happened with there's an entire thread that kind of details all of the male players that have in one way or another sort of gotten in Ramos's face. There's Novak Djokovic.
Ramos, specifically this umpire, you're saying,
this
not just
umpire
to behave this way in general, but with this particular umpire.
Yeah. So, you know, there's Novak Djokovic at the French Open. There's Nick Kyrgios, Andy Murray. the men have not faced penalties this severely. But, you know, we've seen men who get really emotional about these games. all the time and who have smashed rackets. You know, I mean, John McEnroe was sort of notorious when it comes to this. But so, there's an issue, I think, because of the sort of double standard when it comes to behavior, and particularly with tennis, which is very effete, very...
it's a very,
you know,
proper,
very civilized,
a very proper
very
set
proper.
Of rules, right? Well, let me get. I want to bring Michael into the conversation. You've also been keeping up with all of this. What did you make of how Serena was treated on the court?
Well, she was treated unfairly. That's the first thing that needs to be said. Soraya just detailed this sort of behavior from players who are caught up in the heat of the moment of competition. It's not rare at all. But what is rare is the way that the umpire used his discretion in this case, and he used his discretion to penalize the sport's best player. And that was one of my primary reactions to this is we're talking about racism and sexism directed against Serena yet again instead of her accomplishments on the court. And it's a pattern that tennis can't seem to rid itself of. It keeps getting caught up in these controversies because of the way it treats the best player in its history. No other sport would undermine itself the way that tennis is.
You're thinking, well, it was just a few weeks ago there was a controversy about her attire.
Yes,
the French
we can't
Open.
Even go mm-hmm. three, 4 weeks without this sort of controversy swirling around Serena.
So I just want to invite listeners again to say, please join us. This is Join the Conversation. We want to hear from you on this. Do you think people are missing the big picture? Do you think tennis is missing the important picture? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. I want to add a number of other tennis players were quick to defend Serena. Here's Billie Jean King, a noted tennis player. When a woman is emotional, she's hysterical, and she's penalized for it. That she wrote, when a man does the same, he's outspoken and there are no repercussions. Thank you, Serena Williams, for calling out this double standard. Here's James Blake, a retired professional player. He tweeted, I'll admit that I've said worse and not gotten penalized. And I've also been given a soft warning by the ump where they'll tell you to knock it off or I'll give you a violation. So, I mean, the interesting thing about Blake's comment is that it gives a sense that this isn't really all that rigid. It's not that every time you break a racket or every time you say something inappropriate, you will automatically get a penalty and it's always enforced. No, there is this discretion. Michael, you mentioned the discretion.
Yeah, and I just can't understand why it is that we see it in tennis and we continue to hear this narrative, well, you broke the rules, you pay a price. That line has already been disproven several times over. So we need to be talking about why discretion is really what's driving this issue. And when you want to know why, you have to start understanding stereotypes of womanhood as overly emotional, as Billie Jean King said, and in particular, stereotypes of black womanhood as aggressive and threatening.
I want to go to the calls. We've got some fascinating calls. First from Nawal in Shrewsbury. Nawal, what have you got to say?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I don't want to judge anything over here because I'm not, you know, at that level of a judge. But I think the point I want to make is that the whole world and, you know, our kids are looking at these professionals, these stars, as their role models. And behavior, I think, is extremely important for such role models to portray to the world that they're, you know, while they've accomplished tremendous things in their professional fields, behavior also is a part that should be portrayed. So just because men are showing bad behavior on the court and getting away with it isn't an excuse for a woman to do the same thing. Now, I'm not saying a man is a, you know, the gender issue aside, it could be that, but two wrongs don't make a right.
So this is a good...
Something bad, I don't want to do that. You know, I shouldn't get that either. So,
Noel makes this point. I mean, maybe it's too easy on Serena to say, well, lots of men have gotten away with equally bad behavior, therefore she should. Soraya, what do you think?
So I don't think it's necessarily as clear-cut as that, and this is why. Because this is not sort of behavior that is typical of Serena. And I would say that, you know, there's a long history that's basically been leading up to this. Serena has been playing professional tennis for about 23 years. And in that entire time, she has been subject to the sort of disrespect that other white players and other male players have not. You know, from the very moment that she was scheduled to play her sister Venus at Indian Wells, when the animosity that they faced was so bad that they basically boycotted that venue for years and years. She has faced doubts about, you know, her honesty. She's drug tested more than almost any player in the sport, right? She has been criticized by authorities within the sport, even, you know, former players, even people who run tournaments because they don't like what she wears or they don't like her body. They don't like the fact that that she doesn't look like the typical white female tennis player, tall, long legs, very lithe, skinny, blonde, right? She's muscular. She's, you know, she's a power hitter. She's unafraid to use that power. And so there's this perception of her that she's bullying, right? That she's, you know, this hulking person who's just sort of smacking these other girls around, and she's big, mean Serena.
And so that's sort of, in some ways,
this weekend's events.
She's been dealing with this
for a really long time.
It's been building up to moments like this. In fact, there have been lots along the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the thing is, you know, role models are still human beings. You know, they still have feelings. And this, you know, especially when it comes to accusations that she's too mannish. You know, Serena has expressed, you know, that's something that's hurtful to her. You know, she did an interview with the New York Times a few years ago where she basically admitted that she doesn't even lift weights anymore because she got so self-conscious about her body.
So I just want to get to another caller because, I mean, well, let's just get to Valerie from Hyde Park. Valerie, do you want to get something to add? We'd love to hear from you.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I was watching the match, and I was rooting for Osaka. I thought Serena was playing well, but I thought that Osaka was playing equally well. And what really bothered me the most was that, as I understand it, there's a code of discipline or a code of conduct in tennis, and that there's discretion on the part of the line judge. In each instance where he had the option to, you know, issue a warning or a penalty, he went right to the penalty each time. And I didn't see, other than the racket breaking, I didn't see anything disrespectful or untoward in Serena's behavior. But what really seemed to happen to me was that this line judge inserted himself so much into this competition that it became about him. And I felt like he robbed Osaka of her victory. She won fair and square. And, I mean, seeing her pulling her visor down and in tears at the award ceremony, it was just heartbreaking to me.
Yeah,
it became all about him and his calls, and I felt like everybody lost. It looked like everybody was out there and, you know, being recognized, and nobody wanted to be there. Nobody wanted to claim the victory. Here's this poor woman who's trained for her entire 20 years of her life, and she won fair and square. And I felt like she had that taken from her.
Oh, thanks so much, Valerie. I mean, it is true that we are here the day or 2 days after talking about Serena Williams, not talking about the player who actually won the day. We're also talking about the umpire who inserted himself into this match. Michael, does it? Yeah, what do you make of that?
That's what I mean about the sport sort of shooting itself in the foot here. I mean, there's no reason. This is a self-made controversy. There's no reason that we should be talking about this. The caller is right. It does rob Osaka of the celebration that she deserves. And look, if you want to talk about Serena being a role model, the way she's handled this whole thing and tried to get our attention back on the right things. In addition to the sexism, during the award ceremony on the court, she embraces Osaka and tries to lift her up and has spoken about her own conduct and her willingness to speak out about this as something that she's doing not just for her own sake and the sake of her career, but for the sake of all the women who come after her. So if you don't like every single move that she makes on the court, you should still be able to look at the total impact of her career and the way she carries herself, especially in moments like this when she's being treated unfairly. And the uncommon grace that she exudes during these moments is really something to behold. She's as much of a role model as any of us could hope for in a professional athlete.
Soraya, would you want to say something?
Sure. I was going to say, I think there's a really special relationship at play with Naomi Osaka and Serena Williams. You know, she's spoken about her before, a couple of years ago, before she was really on anyone's radar except for sort of people who are just tennis mad.
Before she was.
Yes. And she said, oh, man, this girl is dangerous, you know. And Naomi Osaka has been very very clear about how much inspiration she takes from Serena Williams in particular. You know, she herself is the little sister in a tennis family. Her father, you know, sort of modeled his coaching style and his daughter's careers after the Williams sisters. You know, Serena Williams is a hero to her.
So I also want to take this conversation a little bit beyond tennis, because in some ways that's the piece of it we're looking at the moment. Well, let's go to Kim from Newton. Kim, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
I'd love to hear what your thoughts.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, this has happened to me so many times. I can't even tell you. This is not about tennis for me. And I grew up in Miami playing a lot of tennis, seeing a lot of tennis. This is about this man, this white Latin male, saying to this black African-American female, how dare you talk to me that way? That is what this is about. And it has happened to me so many times when I have spoken up, and I'm a very outspoken person, to a reservations agent or on an airline, and a white male will come say to me, to my face, either Missy, they've actually said Missy, or, you know, I heard the way you're talking to him and, you know, dressed me down. And that's what happened. And I guarantee you there's a lot of other women who have felt that way. And whether they're women of color or just women that, you know, I'm a middle-aged woman, and this, I've been talked to like I was a little girl. And it's because it's sexism, and it's men not accepting that a woman could be their equal or talk to them in a way that they didn't approve. That's what this was. It was a how dare you moment.
Thank you so much for sharing, Kim. Michael, did you look at it as a tennis moment, or is it a social moment? Is it both? How did it resonate?
Both. It's both. I mean, the research is clear on this. You know, there's a study released by the National Women's Law Center in 2017 that showed that black girls in school are suspended at a rate five times that of their peers. There's a book by Andrea Ritchie called Invisible No More about police and state violence against black women and women of color. We know that there are dramatic and inexcusable disparities in the ways that women of color and black women in particular are disciplined by authority figures, whether it's in school, whether it's out in the street by police, or whether it's in a sports venue or on the field of play by umpires. So that is the broader context here. And Serena knows that. I mean, she's no fool. She's had many of the same experiences her entire life. And yet she's chosen to kind of thread the needle and make herself visible, make her race visible in a way so as not to upset the possibility of a broader feminist alliance with the women who are coming after her. It's incredibly politically shrewd, and it's a very humble and self-effacing move. And again, the grace that she exhibits under these circumstances, it's just rare.
One thing that you can see, I mean, that struck me just looking at this moment, if you look at it as a social moment, is that you can actually keep both things in your head at the same time. You could say, maybe she did break she broke her racket. That was an infraction. Maybe there was some breaking of infraction. It's nonetheless the case that for equivalent infractions, people of different genders or women and minorities are going to be punished more for the same kinds of infractions. So you can feel like, well, maybe she shouldn't have done it. And also, there's some bigger problem here.
Not only that, but the performance, right? Merely the performance of anger and aggression. When men do it on the field in play, it's read differently, socially speaking, by the media and by onlookers than it is when women do it. When men do it, it's a sign of their passion for the sport, their commitment to the team, their desire to win. When women do it, it's a sign that they're having a quote-unquote meltdown, right? It's just a terrible double standard. It makes no sense.
And yet it does seem like people are rushing to her defense. I mean, Soraya, did you feel in the stadium anybody was a mass of people critical of our activity? Or it sounded from your description that
everyone supportive. Was booing Ramos.
Yeah.
To the point that, I mean, when that match ended, when Naomi, you know, served out the match, everyone was upset. And Yeah. And they were upset with Carlos Ramos. I don't think they were upset with Serena Williams.
And I think a lot of people watching, listening, are upset, continue to be upset. That's why one reason we're talking about it. That's Soraya Nadia McDonald. She's culture critic for The Undefeated. Her piece in The Undefeated is titled Serena Williams is Owed an Apology for Much More Than a Penalty. We've got a link on our website, radioboston.org. Also with me in studio is Michael Jeffries. He's Associate Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. Thank you both for being with me.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.